Sometimes we hit a point in life where everything feels like it's falling apart and we are forced to rebuild from the ground up. That can feel absolutely terrifying, but it is so beautiful in so many ways. This week on The Good Glow, I sit down with Anna Runkle. She's known all over the world as the Crappy Childhood Fairy, and she's a writer, a teacher, and a trauma recovery coach. But this conversation, I think you're going to love it, because it probably will feel like you're just sitting next to two people having such a deep and meaningful conversation. It is so good. I actually loved editing this podcast. Today, Anna opens up about the breakdown of her marriage, the moment she realized that she could stop fighting and start healing, how she rebuilt her life, how she regulates her emotions after years of chaos. She shares such a relatable story about losing her temper with a neighbor and how you can get yourself over that and release that guilt from your body. She talks about crap fitting, which is when we mold ourselves to fit into situations or relationships that no longer serve us, how we can make friends, how we can move forward, how we can build a life that we truly love. These are the conversations we need to be having. Anna's book, Connectability, is brilliant and it's out now. So excited to bring this conversation to you. Before we get into it, talking about connectability, talking about joy, leaning into your tribe, connecting with people who are going to make you feel uplifted and joyful and happy. Our Christmas show, Jingle All The Way, is coming to the National Concert Hall on the 6th of December. It's a Saturday evening, 7 p.m, right at the start of the Christmas season. We are going to officially launch Christmas together. We have really inspiring talks. You're going to be punching the air after this show. Beautiful Christmas music, lots of fun, lots of laughs. Lots of people ask me if they can come to this show alone. Absolutely you can. You will feel so welcomed. Don't be shy. I'll leave a link for the tickets in the show notes, and I will see you together, all of us, on the 6th of December as we welcome the festive season together. Anna, I'm so thrilled. Thank you for joining me on The Good Glow. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. It's really nice to meet you, Georgie.
Yeah, congratulations on your new book. I can't wait to dive right in. But first, tell us in Ireland a little bit about you and where in the world you are today.
Well, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I actually grew up here. I was raised in a commune in Berkeley in the late 60s and early 70s. It was quite a time here. And it's a lot why I ended up with childhood trauma. It was a very unstable time in our family and many families. And my trauma ended up being very hard for me to manage. And then when I learned what to do about it, it turned into a wonderful way of life. And today, my whole work is aimed at helping people who kind of need the memo that we were supposed to get as kids, but didn't get it then.
Yeah, and it's such a different time now, and we're so educated, and there's people like you showing us the way. But what was it like for you growing up?
Well, the problem with our family, you know, a lot of people think communes, peace and love, but it wasn't really like that. It was a lot of drinking, drugs, violence. The kids all got neglected. And if it weren't for some really caring teachers, back in a time when teachers were allowed to help in this way, they let me bring my little sister to school with me for a long time. And she got to eat lunch with us there. She was 3 and I was 8. And yeah, so that I'm really grateful for the teachers and the parents, the moms in the neighborhood, where the way that people handled things then was it just quietly they helped out. Nobody reported anybody. And perhaps it was for the best.
Wow. And yeah. Through your own work then, turning that into helping other people, like when did that breakthrough come for you, or was it gradual?
Well, luckily in many ways, my sort of trauma-driven adaptation was to be super competent. I became an over-functioner at a young age. And if you had to have one adaptation, I think that's a nice one to have. It's better than like falling into addiction or giving up. And so at least I was trying hard. I was trying to look good and act normal and make sure the younger kids were cared for. But in my 20s is when it started to really backfire on me. I was so stressed out. I was feeling really alienated from people. I was very intense. So a friend called me a serrated knife.
Oh my God.
My energy was that rough. And I always felt like, well, I have to be like this. You don't understand. You know, I was like on a treadmill going, you know, 10 miles an hour all the time. And I felt like I could never get off. So that was, it was hard on my body. It was hard on my emotions. It made relationships difficult. And then towards the end of my 20s, I had a set of crises. My mother died. I got my heart broken a little before that. And I got attacked on the street totally randomly. And psychologically, I handled it okay. It was quite violent. They broke my jaw and my teeth. But I think what I had was PTSD. And this was 30 years ago. They didn't think of PTSD back then as something that people who were not in combat get. But I had a lot of difficulty paying attention, regulating my emotions, interpreting reality well, sleeping at the right time, like everything was thrown off. And today I know I had PTSD. Today I know that what was going on was dysregulation of my nervous system. And thankfully, you know, we now talk about that. We talk about dysregulation as an underlying problem with trauma, which otherwise, and still by some practitioners, they think of it as surely psychological or social. It is those things. But underneath it all, there's a nervous system injury. And if you're not dealing with that, it's very hard to benefit from any other way of helping yourself.
Wow. And your book, Connectability, it's so fabulous. It's out in October. I wish I had a physical copy to hold up, but you do it for us. How beautiful. I love the way that ability is like, visually, it's forward.
Yeah. Yes, genius. Exactly it.
Yeah. It's so good.
I collaborated with the art team at Hay House with that. And I just love what they did. I was like, ability, it's on fire. It came running into the screen. It's like, it's a verb. And it's a character trait that you can develop. And a lot of people with trauma, this is what's invisible about trauma, is it can leave you with this sense of never connecting. Mm-hmm. It can leave you with a sense that there's a wall between you and other people, or a membrane, some people describe it, feeling like you never belong, you never quite fit in, you're never quite understood. And there are so many reasons for that. One of them is the nervous system injury. Without that, nothing else works. But it's also social. If you had parents who, you know, had addictions like I did, they were not emotionally present to notice when I was getting into emotional trouble or trying to figure out how to deal with people. They couldn't teach me that. They were too, you know, lost in their own problems. And so I always thought, I wish there was some book, like an etiquette book, for people from the wrong side of the track. So that's kind of what my life's work is. I teach people, like, here's how you do it. Here's how you do life. I had to figure it out by trial and error.
Yeah, because
I summarize it.
Because I was thinking there, like, there's people probably that struggle with connection and they have no idea where that has come from and would never even dream of linking it to their childhood trauma. But of course it makes sense. And in the book, very early on, you speak about almost this rock bottom moment where you felt so disconnected. Your parents had passed, you'd been through a divorce, you were on your own with your kids, and that feeling of just having no one to turn to is so sad, but so relatable for so many people.
Yeah, I thought I had friends. I did have a lot of people in my life. My life was populated, but I learned when I needed friends the most that my friendships were fairly shallow. They were not the kind of friendships where people will sort of drop everything and make sure that your kids are picked up from daycare when you're not able to move, you're in the hospital, you know. I didn't have those kind of people, and it was a real crisis. And going through that at the time of a divorce was really challenging too, because like all divorces, it was really, there was a lot of tension and anger and blame going around. And one of the good things about this period is I just really had to get on my knees and figure out, how am I going to do this? And one of the things I learned is to stop arguing with my ex. Like, it turns out you could just like not do that. You can, and nothing happens as a result, except that you can plan the you know, trade-off of kids. And we're friends today, and his wife.
Did you make that decision yourself, Anna, or did he have to be on board for that?
He didn't have to be on board. He never knew that I was doing it. Later, I found out that he had his own ways of trying to calm things. And I really am grateful for that. He was trying it too. But here's what's special about him is, it was a very difficult marriage, but the the moment that we split up was when he started using my daily practice techniques. And this is what's interesting. We want to believe that if we do something helpful, it's going to make everything work out. Like that would have, at the time, I didn't want to be like left with a 1-year-old and a 4-year-old, you know, and not enough work. I was terrified, but it really was not a good marriage. And what the daily practice that I use, some techniques that I teach in the book and in my YouTube channel and online, there are these simple techniques that help you sort of get the noise of the fearful and resentful thoughts and feelings kind of moved out of the way for a while so that you can think clearly, you can perceive reality, truth comes to you, insight comes to you, intuition, it starts to come back to you. All that stuff is lost when you're in a trauma storm.
Yes.
Yeah.
So did you say when he started doing your practice, that's when your marriage broke down?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
He just came to the front door and I remember he was like glowing and I was just like, so did you like it? Did you like learning it? Cause he learned it from somebody other than me. He had a man show him how to do it. And he said, we got to get divorced.
Oh my gosh.
But he was right. It was true. I knew it was true, but I just was really scared. But the techniques allowed me to just keep showing up for life one day at a time and do what needed to be done.
Yes.
Just to do what I needed to do, which was increase my income, find better daycare, come up with systems, and learn how to connect with other people successfully in a way that I had never known how to do before. I didn't have the old props. I wasn't like a 21-year-old cute girl. You know, I didn't have a lot of things that'll sort of buy you some time if you're having trouble connecting. And so I had to learn that. And I undertook a serious, almost monastic period of time to learn how do you do this. And this book is what I learned to do. And today I enjoy great relationships. I'm happily remarried. I have good relationships with my kids. I have women friends, which I think is very precious, but yeah, hard to have sometimes for people like me. It didn't used to come easily. And my husband and I have big potlucks at our house often. And then I have the pleasure and joy of sharing my story online. I didn't think I could do that. I can't believe how honest I am. You can't blackmail me. Everything embarrassing or shameful about the past is already out there in videos that I made to explain, like, I know how it is. I know how hard it gets. And I know how you think you can't possibly get out of this. And it's very tempting. This is what happens. We pull away. When it gets that hard, we protect ourselves by staying home, by avoiding people. And sometimes even when we're out there seeming to have a connected life, there's this thing I call covert avoidance, where we're going through the motions of being social, but we're holding everybody at arm's length. Mm-hmm. Nobody really knows what's going on. And you're not really knowing them either, because there's a lot of self preoccupation when your life is in pain. It's very hard to care about others fully. It's a two-way street, isn't it? We learn to be present with other people and both people can start to connect.
Yeah.
It's not something you can't really connect with people all by yourself. But I found a lot of people were available for connection, but they hadn't been the people that I was choosing before. I think on some level I couldn't see. I was afraid of those people because I was ashamed of myself.
Mm. Oh, that's so powerful. And I think my thoughts when I was reading your book was, you find yourself in this book. Like, you may not be in that category, but then you find yourself in the next. And Anna, like, just something about Ireland, just to explain to you kind of what our culture is like here. So Ireland is so small, and we grow up here. And we all go, you know, we go to the local primary school, local secondary school for the most part. And then we go off to college. But it's so small here that we often stay friends with the people who we've been friends with since we're 5. And it could be a group of 12 girls. And then we find that as we grow and experience things at different stages and experience trauma at different ages, and I've heard it from so many people in my community, like with my run club and the community that I've created through the podcast, that they may not necessarily want to be friends anymore in the nicest possible way, but they don't know where to go or where to turn.
Yeah, I think even in big cities, we sometimes do that. We populate our lives with people who don't fit, as well as people who have been unkind to us and people whose lives are so troubled that it just brings a lot of chaos into our lives.
Mm.
And when that's going on, there's not really room for your people.
Yes.
And that's what the book Connectability is about, is finding your people and feeling like you belong with them. And it's a, there's a lot of areas of growth to be done all at the same time. You don't have to do it perfectly. You don't have to be all fixed before you start putting your foot out the front door to give it a go.
Yeah. And how did you find your tribe?
Well, one of the things I had to do was become more honest about myself. And
yes,
when I was in a bad marriage, that was something that I didn't talk to other people about. And having little kids, I was trying to be accepted by the mom groups. I was actually getting bullied by this neighborhood full of women for reasons that actually had nothing to do with me, which didn't help. And that can be a hard thing. I made a video about that recently on YouTube, and it just like, it just went to the moon. So many people had experienced that, where women can be very hard on each other.
Yes, I watched it.
Emotionally immature women. Those are not good people to surround yourself with, and it's not worth trying to connect with them. But I lived in a rural area. It was, you know, I had kids. They had kids. There are a lot of reasons to stay connected with people, even when they're not your people.
Yeah.
But I finally got out of there, and I started to... The monastic period I told you, I really worked on my life. I changed a lot of things. I set right some of the problems in my life, some of the ways that I had been, you know, unkind to other people. I set it right, and I could hold my head up again, and I felt more confident reaching out and connecting with people. And it was very trial and error. You know, I would go to 12-step meetings. I'd go to church. I would go, I would try people and try to find my people. And so often the experience was, I'd get in there, I go, this is great, I'm going to be part of this group, and they will all be my friends, and I'll sign up, and I'll play a volunteer role, and I'll, you know, I'll make lunch for everybody. And then, you know, a week later, I was just like, oh, what have I done? And part of that was because it wasn't a fit, but part of that was because I was going too fast. When you've been isolating to manage your own stress and dysregulation all your life, it's almost like being from another planet, or like being a baby.
Yeah.
In some way, there's a delayed development where we have to learn how to start tolerating. What is it? Shakespeare called it the slings and arrows.
Yeah.
You know, it's just some being with people is triggering. And I use the word trigger to mean something that makes you get dysregulated. But that's kind of what goes on with people who get dysregulated. And it might have been trauma, or it might be that somebody's an introvert. Maybe somebody's on the autism spectrum, and doing people is just stressful.
Mm-hmm.
So there needs to be a way to tolerate stress without always using avoidance as a way to handle it. You know, when you don't have a way to handle the stress, if you do a social interaction that's very stressful for you, it could make you exhausted for the evening. It could make you feel like you can't really go to work the next day. It's devastating when your whole nervous system gets wrecked by you know, a difficult interaction or somebody's rude to you. And we have to be a little bit more robust than that. We have to be able to have a boundary and just be like, okay, not that person. And I don't have to argue with them about it. I just have to walk over here and talk to somebody else.
Yeah.
And some of it is simple. We also have to recover our perception. A lot of us have damaged perception. And I think that living so much of our life online isn't always helpful. We can learn a lot, but we also end up sort of in some algorithm where everybody's like blaming other people for their problems. And that can be a bad rabbit hole to go down, of just like, well, I can't help being awful and unhelpful and rude. This is what society has done to me. And sometimes that's true, but if it's true forever, it's you who loses out. It's you who loses out. And so I had to let go of a lot of my anger and my sense of being aggrieved, because there were many ways I didn't get a fair shot. You know, growing up poor, growing up neglected.
Mm-hmm.
Like, nobody told me how you go to college. Eventually I figured it out and went late, but literally nobody encouraged me to go to college. And I was a bright kid. So for a long time I was angry. I was like, it's not fair. And this is why I'm in debt now. But it was, you know, who's going to do anything about it?
Yeah.
Me, that's who. I'm going to get it together. I'm going to, you know, increase my income. I'm going to show up better with other people. I'm going to be more discerning about who I let into my life. And for me, having little kids made it mandatory that I do that. You know, my old ways of just like, oh, whoever. You can't do that with kids.
Yeah. It's so powerful, isn't it, to change your mind about who you are, who you told yourself you are. I mean, yeah. I have to work really hard not to be a chaotic person. And mm-hmm. for so many years, I told myself that I was born chaotic, but of course I wasn't. It was a learned behavior that now I have to put tools in place not to be chaotic, because I know I deserve more than the chaos, you yes. know? One thing that I find is, like, a lot of people would think that I am very social and outgoing and comfortable with chatting to people and getting to know people. But what I suffer with is the hangover of the vulnerability hangover. It's showing up as my true self, but then thinking I've pushed it too far. I've been too much of myself. I'm too much for people. And you speak about that in the book as well.
Yes. That vulnerability hangover. Did you make that up? That's so accurate.
Yeah, I've spoken about it before.
That is just the right word. Yeah, the vulnerability hangover. There was hardly ever a conversation I had that I didn't afterward be like, oh, why did I say that? I didn't even have information to know that it had landed badly. Or I did,
yes.
But even when I didn't, I would be full of remorse. And it would just consume huge amounts of my energy and cause me to retract into myself again. So the daily practice that I teach, it's very simple. It takes paper and pen and a chair. Anybody can do it. I taught it to my children. They still use it as adults. But I taught it to my ex-husband. He left me. But we need to get to the truth of things. We need to not just like soldier on miserably. Mm. You know, we need to go, you know what, this isn't working. We have to come up with something better. That's good. That's progress sometimes. And the daily practice can help release all that. So that feeling of remorse after talking to people, when you always have paper and pen with you, and I would teach you this right now. It takes a little longer than we have right now, but I have a free course. I'll give you the link to that.
Oh, great.
I teach it in the book. I teach it in my first book, Reregulated. Oh, there's that right there.
That's fab.
It's a deep teaching and it's a great way of life. And I think about 1 million people are doing it now from learning about it, from a YouTube channel and taking the free course. It's just,
oh, wow. I'm definitely going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you'll like it because it's a way to get all those thoughts just out. And there might be some that you need to pay attention to and they will be there for you, but you get this free time where something new can happen in your mind and you can read reality a little more accurately. And when you're in reality, reality is a beautiful place, this place we've been running from because we didn't have coping tools to help us face it. Cause it's hard. It feels, you know, there's self-criticism involved. Other people will criticize you. They will ostracize you. Sometimes you need a way to bear it so that you can carry on and keep building the life that you want to have and the connections that you want to have and not give up. Mm. So it's a way to create space for that and emotional tolerance for things that hurt, that you think you can't take, but they're not really so terrible if you know how to just like get rid of them.
Yeah. And you speak in the book about writing your fears and resentments down. Yes. And that's so powerful.
Yeah. I think every terrible thing that people have ever done to each other is motivated by fear and resentment. And everything yes. terrible we've done to ourselves was motivated by that too. And it's human to have that, but it's growth to know how to separate yourself from it a little bit. Some of it is information. Some of it is something you need to be angry about and you need to take action on, but hardly any of it. Some of it is just noise. It's literally people, when we're traumatized as kids, especially through neglect, it can create an injury where it's difficult to process thoughts and feelings that are painful. And process means change them from a state where they're activating all your adrenaline and cortisol and stress response to where they're merely a memory, but they're not activating your whole body into it as if it's all happening now.
Yeah.
That's what it's like to have unhealed trauma, is you're activated about things that aren't happening right now. And it's very noisy. It's very exhausting. And it makes it necessary to pull away from people.
Yeah. Oh, it's so fascinating. I absolutely love it. There was another really interesting point in your book about teaching your heart that you belong. And I just thought that was so beautifully put and so compassionate to yourself and something we all need to do.
Everyone does belong. It's a fact, but it doesn't feel like that. It doesn't feel like that. And part of that might literally be a neurological injury from neglect. And I call it an injury, not like it's not necessarily a hopeless state. But my mother used to like flee the family for a month at a time, starting when I was a month old. She'd just run off with some man and nobody knew whether she was coming back. And I don't remember it, but I can imagine what that would have been like for a baby. How uncertain and scared, and how I might have gotten into that thing of like, that's okay, I'll just deal with everything by myself, you know, as a baby.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll just deal with it by myself. But what that interaction with parents is meant to be is loving and connected, and it's critical to our neurological development to help us have things like mirror neurons, where we're attuned to other people, we can read the room, we can sense when we're in danger. All of that stuff might have received a developmental delay.
Yeah.
And I insist it's a delay. We might as well assume it's just a delay. We got to work on it. If there is, let's say, like in the case of people who have autism, and they've taught me so much, they learn social skills. You know, the way that they're wired might not be attuned to something. So they learn how to act like they're attuned just so that they can hang out with people and, you know, go to work and have a life. And it may not come naturally, and that's okay. You know, many people are going through life successfully, even though they don't have a leg or they don't have a home. And so we find ways to adapt and to make the best of our situation where it is. And sometimes I feel like the culture that I grew up in and the culture that sort of evolved since then has underrated how much that sort of can-do spirit can help us get through things in the best way we can. And that really a happy life is possible under many circumstances. You know, I said when somebody doesn't have a home, I think that's really important for people to have a home. But not having one is the starting place that many, many, many of us have had.
Yeah. And did you find, you know, you connected with people? Was it like one by one, or was it in a group setting, or how did you kind of immerse yourself into people?
That's a really good question. No one's asked me that. So slowly I did it. I didn't always notice I was getting better at it. It was sometimes like hiking up a mountain where you look back after a while and you're like, oh, look at the altitude. And I realized something had gotten better and the old thing wasn't happening anymore.
Mm.
Like I used to think, and I don't think this was crazy, but like the jobs I had, I always felt like I was underestimated. I think that's common for traumatized people. I just felt like I wasn't really given credit for things. I wasn't given a break. And probably my part in that was episodes of emotional dysregulation or nervous system collapse where I didn't really come through at the right time every time. But gosh, I worked my butt off. And I used to think, well, I hid all my feelings so successfully. Don't I get a prize for that? But because I wasn't really connecting with reality and other people, there were things that I was missing. And so working on one part of my life, I suddenly started getting better in other parts of my life. I think, oh, look at that. I don't feel underestimated anymore. If anything, I feel like people, you know, being a YouTuber, you probably experienced this with your podcast. Sometimes people are so kind and you wake up and there's, you know, 7 comments in a row saying something positive about you. And you just think, have they lost their minds? You know, and then you think, no, I did a good job. It was helpful.
There's something in your book that Irish people are going to be obsessed with, and that's the crap fit.
Really? That's good. I have some Irish friends, and yeah, crap fit is my word for when you fit yourself to unacceptable people and situations. And my Irish friends, I would say if I were to generalize about the Irish character, they're very different people, of course, but sometimes, oh, they could be so snarky about other people, but it's sort of muttered. And then there's this like total cheer on the outside. And like, oh, we're fine.
Yeah. The crap fit is interesting because I suppose from a small island, you are probably crap fitting into a lot of things that you don't want to be in anymore.
Yeah, that's a survival strategy. And thank God we had it as children, because that's how we kept our spirits intact. Mm-hmm. We just were like, fine, I can deal with it. But then doing that, it was sort of an unconscious pact with our future selves that we were going to undo that later, that we're not going to take crap all our lives. And when we carry that into adulthood, we end up in terrible relationships and terrible jobs with awful neighbors. And we just keep thinking, I'll just have to be nicer. I'll just have to shut myself down. I'll have to make myself smaller and then they'll be nice. But as many of us have found out, it doesn't work. And so it's time to stop playing small and not to fit yourself to things, to start having standards. When I coach people, one of the hardest things for people who have grown up this way with trauma is for them to be able to claim some decent standards, just some ordinary normal person standards. Like for me, the hard one was I'm not going to date anybody who has a drug or alcohol problem. Like literally I used to tolerate that and boy, did I pay. And I just had to draw a hard line and just be like, I don't care how cute they are. I don't care how, you know, compassionate and understanding and exciting they are. I can't do that. I have kids. That's something I can't do. And it's a weak spot. Having grown up with a lot of addiction, I have this strange blind spot. I can't see it coming.
Wow.
So it's just like, I can't do it. And I would have to ask people like up front. And and so I started to have standards. I also would not date people who were not interested in marriage. That's what I wanted. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't even like waste time on one date with somebody who wasn't open to that. Then with kids, you know, I knew, you know, for when kids do get abused, one of the likely culprits is a step parent. And so if we're even thinking of dating after a divorce with kids, oh, we have to be so careful. We have to be so careful. So I knew that I had to set my standards like higher than I could imagine, that it would have to turn out really well. And you know what? I only ever dated one person after I did that, after my monastic period of setting standards and really adopting them and incorporating them, about like the only people who get into my life have to be good for me and my kids and the future and all these things I had never had to really be responsible for or wasn't responsible for, but I am. And I only ever dated one person after I did that. And he's in the house right now. He's
oh, wow.
We've been together 17 years. Yeah. And we're married and he's a really, really good man. And that even dating a good man was very challenging for me, very triggering. Mm. I got to learn a lot about what it's like when you don't feel that good about yourself and you think you're dating out of your league and having to get up on your toes. And that's a lot why I learned. That's the thing that cracked it open for me as I read Bessel van der Kolk's book. And I did it because I had acted in a emotionally dysregulated way towards him when we were engaged. And he was like, you know what? This is not okay. I was like raging about something. And I got that book and I found out that there's a word for what was going on with me. It's called complex PTSD. It comes from chronic ongoing exposure to stress. And one of the core symptoms is dysregulation. And so he gave it some time to sort of see, watch me demonstrate what I could do with that information. And it helped me so much to just like, once you have a name for what's wrong, yeah. And you realize like, it's not your fault, but it is, now you got to deal with it. Like nobody's going to run in and fix you. Once I had that, I was able to make progress very quickly, and it wasn't long. Maybe 2 years after that, I started a blog about what I had learned, then the YouTube channel, and then next thing you know, we all were quitting our jobs to work for Crappy Childhood Fairy. This just sort of took over our lives as the biggest thing we'd ever done in our lives was serving the world in this way.
Oh, I love it. Two more questions for you. Just the second last question is, like, how did you, or are you able to kind of put it into words how you went from that time in your life where you felt like you had nobody to where you are now, like you said at the start of the call, doing potluck with your husband and living a full, happy life?
Yeah. Well, it's a gradual process. There were a couple punctuating points, and those are good for storytelling, but it's a daily process, and every day presents a problem. You know, I remember, oh gosh, last year I was shooting a course in my living room and I had a paid crew coming in, and my neighbor was doing very noisy work outside, and we had made a plan. We had made a plan. I'm going to be shooting in my house on this day, and can you tell me when you're not going to do this noisy work, and I'll shoot on those days. And she did it three different times in a row. And I eventually had to abandon the project, and I still had to pay the crew. And I was so mad. I went out there and yelled at her. And her work crew was there. Everybody was looking at me. I was like the crazy lady yelling that I don't want to be. I was mad. I had my reasons. I don't think she ever understood that. I think there was a misunderstanding that when I said not on this day, she heard me as saying, you have no right to work on your house. It's one of those things that happens, you know, it just happened. But I was so ashamed of like making a scene. I was like screaming at her in public. Soon the neighbors were out there. It only went on for a couple minutes, but it was enough in our serene little street, you know, that people were like, what is that? I was so embarrassed. And I very quickly had to go into my daily practice and I had to pray. I had to do the work. I had to physically exercise and get it out of my body so that within 24 hours I could go apologize to her about that. And she was very cool about it, actually. So that's, I have whole like modules in my courses. This is how you do an apology when you've just made a total idiot of yourself. Oh. I know how to do that. I've had to do that many times, in fact. And so it's not like it never happens anymore, but when we're tired and run down and we haven't been, you know, really staying on top of the rough edges of life, I wasn't eating well. I wasn't sleeping well. I was feeling like I was back on that treadmill feeling. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of time pressure. And I just wasn't balancing it. And but what I have is I have this wonderful tool called How to Make a Clean Apology. And that's the best I can do. And when you know how to do that, then you don't have to be terrified you're going to make a mistake. You don't have to be terrified of yourself. So just to say, what's the process like? It's like there's these glitches sometimes, but I know what to do. I know what to do. And I don't make mistakes like that very often anymore. And when you're not making mistakes like that very often anymore, the people in your life tend to be better, kinder, more caring people. And that helps you too. And you tend to have a more balanced life so that you do get sleep and you are eating protein and vegetables. Yeah. And just things start to conspire through a lot of little things to support you in taking one step after another, after another. Here's a nice thing the English people say. My husband says this to me because I'm, you know, my mother's from Brooklyn. I'm from Berkeley. So to me, it's like, it's an operatic disaster, you know. He says, no. Positive attitude, one foot in front of the other. The best advice I ever got. It balances me out.
I love it. And something's, and first of all, like, isn't it great that, you know, you can do something like that, but then it makes you, you're so self-aware that you're like, it's because of A, B, C, D, and I'm not doing this and I haven't been doing enough of this. And that's amazing because I think,
you know, the drill.
Yeah. Like my kids were just here a few minutes ago and I was like trying to prep for the podcast and I was like, guys, like, come on, what are you doing? And like, my child is one.
Get it together, baby.
Yeah, like, what is this? This is a joke. But like, I was so disappointed in myself in the moments after that, because I was like, geez, they're home from school. You know, I should have been somewhere else prepping for my podcast. But I think what was so interesting there, what you said, Anna, was moving it out of your body, because that's the step I think so many of us are missing. How do you do that?
Well, some people, you know, I know a lot of people, they directly do body things. If you could do one thing when you're in that overwhelmed state, it's move your body. Just move it. Sweep the floor, run up and down the stairs, go to a yoga class if you've got the time. But that's usually not an option in the moment. So you move your body and that starts to bring you back. And then for the, I call it thinky stuff, you know, this just like, I'm so angry. I can't even think. I get that on paper. That is for the paper. That is for the daily practice to start moving that out. There is a center. We do come back to center. Even newborn babies can come back to center, but they need us for that. They're not able to do it by themselves. Their nervous system is just wild and raw when they're born. So they're, but you know, when you hold and cuddle and feed and interact, they come into focus. They open their eyes. They're interacting. They're not just rigid and freaking out and turning red. We're all going through that. We're learning to manage it. We used to have to manage it by shutting ourselves down, but now we can learn to re-regulate ourselves. So we're not having to shut anything down. We're actually like gently opening up. But I think that when it comes to the urge to isolate, it's one of those changes that is best made very slowly. that we get, it's titration, you know, that word from medicine. Mm. You take a very small dose and you see if you can tolerate it. So you just, for me, the very first connectability step in my book, I have a game in there. You get 1 point for this. Go outside without looking out the window first to make sure nobody's out there. Just go get in your car. If somebody's there, just go, hey. Just that's a, you know, even that is a tough step when you're completely frazzled and overwhelmed by people. So at the same time, you're practicing, keep taking good care of your nervous system. You're practicing saying, hey, and you practice it at the same time, because you can't heal very much about yourself when you're not interacting with people. These are relational wounds, and we learn to get better at them and to catch up on our developmental delay by interacting with people.
Oh, it's fabulous. Your book is amazing. Connectability. I recommend it for everyone to go check it out. Anna, just before you go, could you tell us about the last 5-star moment in your life, like the last perfect moment where everything aligned and you just felt like your heart was full?
Well, my youngest kid and I were in New York City last week. Was it last week? Maybe it was a week and a half ago. And we took a walk in Central Park. My youngest kid and I have a shared love of New York City. So I was there to do a podcast. That was really cool. I was very happy to be there. I had a new sweater to wear. I was at my best. I was feeling good. And I had been hanging out with my publisher, Hay House, and they were so kind and took me to lunch. And so it was already a good day. And then I met my son and we're like, come on, let's walk in Central Park. And it was the golden hour. And he and I have walked in Central Park probably 10 times. We're such fans. And I'm lucky enough, I get to go to New York often to go do a live appearance or something. But this day, Central Park was perfect. And my son is 22. He's not in an age where he tells me everything. He's puts more energy into sort of holding me at arm's length and being close to me. He's individuating. But we are just walking along together and saying one word things to each other, like, this is the best Central Park day, isn't it? We go, yeah, this is the best one. This is the best one. And just stood at a pond and looked at it. And I felt perfectly happy. And so grateful that I get to have kids. That was a dream that I almost didn't get to do with the problems I used to have, but also to have this beautiful connected feeling with my son.
Wow.
That means the world to me.
God, how lucky we are.
Yeah.
Anna, thank you so much. I hope I get to meet you in real life. Anyone
yes.
who comes through Hay House is just a beacon of light for people. And I mean, to be signed by Hay House and releasing books and putting out everything that you are, like, congratulations and thank you so much for everything.
Thank you. I hope we meet too.